How do you move through grief? Is it a straightforward march through the famous five stages, or is it something messier? Mourning a loved one is rarely a brief, orderly process, and for some people, coping with loss is a lifelong challenge. The American Psychiatric Association has given a name to this difficult experience, prolonged grief disorder. Here to share the latest science as well as his personal story is Cody Delestrati, author of the new book, The Grief Cure, Looking for the End of Loss. Cody is a writer and speechwriter and the former culture editor at the Wall Street Journal magazine. Here he is to share five of his key insights.
Hi, I'm Cody Delestrati, a historian and author. When my mother died of cancer, I was a 21-year-old college student trying to do everything right, school, sports, religion, all of it. I hoped that by being a good griever, I could honor her. What that meant to me was moving forward, keeping my grief mostly quiet to myself, not burdening others with it, and getting through the five stages to acceptance and to closure. There's a great societal pressure to get on with life after loss. You have the memorial, you take a few days off work, then it's back to life. But over the course of the past decade, and in writing my book, The Grief Cure, I found out that almost every aspect of what I thought it meant to grieve well was misguided. I also found something surprising along the way, an expanding array of people on the hunt for better and new ways to cope with loss. In The Grief Cure, I explore the question, what if you could cure grief? And with the new technology and science, what would that look like? From chatting with a technologically recreated version of a lost loved one, to opening your mind with the aid of hallucinogenic mushrooms, to the new science of deleting the very memories associated with one's grief, it's a frontier that brims with fresh possibilities and pitfalls for how to cure grief. But The Grief Cure also zooms out. Is a cure really the path we want to take? What is it we have long misunderstood about grief? What might we learn from the past? For something that affects all of us, grief is something about which we speak very rarely. It's hard to imagine any other aspect of life that's both so ubiquitous, yet so shrouded. My goal with this book is to not only uncover new ways of thinking about grief, but to also open a rigorous conversation about it. Here are five of my favorite insights from The Grief Cure. First, it's time to bring grief back into the public sphere. Repressed grief has been linked to negative health outcomes and worse coping mechanisms. Until the early 20th century, most people in the West were open about their grief. Philippe Ariès, a French historian, called this a time of tamed death. Loss and grief were integrated into daily life. Women wore mourning clothes. People corresponded on black-bordered mourning stationery. Some people even wore lockets or jewelry with a deceased loved one's hair. But amid the mass death of the two world wars, there was a political desire to make grief private, in part to support the war effort. Soon after came a rise in so-called happiness culture, and by the 1960s, the English anthropologist Geoffrey Gore was finding in a wide-ranging survey that grief was being considered not a standard aspect of life in the United States and the United Kingdom, but uniquely a burden. Neighbors, worried to ask another how they were doing or for help themselves, were fretful of being an encumbrance. Grieving people reported more trouble connecting with others and health issues, like getting a good night's sleep, than they had in the past. Even while reporting my book, I found people wanted to discuss their loss with others, but they didn't want to overstep an invisible boundary. As I traversed the country to meet with scientists, technologists, doctors, and scholars, I spent many evenings alone in strange cities. Sometimes I'd go out to bars to read just to be around others, and I often ended up speaking openly to my fellow bargoers about my mother's death. I wasn't pushing it, but I wasn't bashful either. It tended to come up naturally when I explained why I was in town. What I found came as a shock. Strangers lit up in shared recognition. One woman from San Francisco told me her husband had recently died, and she'd rarely told anyone. Another in Mexico City told me that his brother had just passed away. He also had mentioned this to very few. In even mentioning my mother's death, many felt like they too could speak about their own experiences with loss. More so, I found almost everyone is dealing with something. Loss boils beneath so many interactions. Yet, in a grief-repressive culture like the United States, discussion now requires a mutual permission giving. Many people want desperately to talk about their loss. They may even want to wear it as conspicuously as one might have in the early 20th century. Yet in today's individualistic culture, where grief lives mostly in the shadows, many of us need to know our conversation partners open to it too. That's something we all can work on for the sake of our grief and our health. The second point is that closure and five stages are mostly myths. Closure is a concept that is so saturated Western culture, it has come to seem like common sense. The problem, it doesn't really exist. It comes from what the sociologist Pauline Boss has called the American mastery-oriented culture, in which we want to solve all that appears to be a problem. A fundamental misunderstanding of grief is that we can only hold a single emotion at a time, as the sociologist Nancy Burns has rightly noted. We don't have to have closure to grieve well. Another supposed common sense point about grief is the psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages. That doesn't really exist at all either. Or at least, we've badly misinterpreted it to mean that there's a prescriptive nature to grief, as in, if you hit each stage, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, then you'll get to acceptance. In reality, Kubler-Ross's research was about how terminally ill people were coping with their own death, not with grieving that of another. And while one study has shown that many people do grieve in a progression that mirrors the five stages, the five stages remains a concept often misinterpreted as a blueprint for how to grieve, as if there are clear directions one can, even should, follow. In my research, one psychiatrist told me she had a patient who was asking her husband to make her angry so she could, quote, get through the anger stage faster. The paradigm of contemporary grief is one oriented toward an imaginary finish line. What if, instead, we use the time of grief to reflect on ourselves and the person we have lost? What if, instead of seeking definitive closure, we reframed it and carried the memory of the loss along with us into the future? The third point is that we must rethink our rituals, making them more personal and more repeatable. Funerals are wildly expensive. The median cost of one with a viewing and burial in the United States is, as of last year, $7,848. For a funeral with cremation, that number is $6,970. For a lot of Americans, that is a debt-incurring expense, like sending your kid to college or buying a house. We would do well to rethink the typical rituals of grief, not only because of their expense, but because continual modes of engaging with the departed are often far more meaningful than one-offs like funerals. Take the Day of the Dead in Mexico, or Obon for Japanese Buddhists. These are celebrations that do not close the book on loss, but instead annually reopen it, allowing people to stay connected, even in their grief. One study from Harvard Business School showed how valuable perpetual rituals are. When describing how they coped with a major loss, 85% of the study's participants reported more creative, individualized rituals that they were able to do over and over again. One person, for instance, described listening to Natalie Cole's Miss You Like Crazy to think about their mom who had died. Another kept returning to the same hair salon where they used to go with a deceased loved one, showing up on the first Saturday of every month as they had once done together. Almost no one said funerals. There's nothing inherently wrong with getting past the pain of loss or wanting to get past it. I don't want to romanticize pain or emotional tumult, nor is there necessarily anything wrong with funerals if they work for you. But trouble does arise when we think of a ritual as the end to our grief rather than the beginning. Fourth, we need to contend with the science, technology, and medicine that could change how we grieve. As we enter a technological, scientific, and medical near future in which certain kinds of pain might be vastly improved, even erased, via neuroscience, psilocybin, pharmaceuticals, artificial intelligence, and otherwise, we would do well to consider that much of grief remains a valuable aspect of being human, that just because something is painful does not mean it necessarily needs to be solved. Perhaps most significantly for grief, the possibility for deleting individual memories via optogenetics was floated by Science magazine a decade ago, after memories were selectively deleted in rodents in a study from the University of California, San Diego. One ethicist of neuroscience to whom I spoke thought something similar might be done in humans in the next 10 to 15 years. So too, there's increasingly intelligent artificial intelligence that can mimic a deceased loved one. And in the case of prolonged grief disorder, recently added to the DSM, an anti-opioid called naltrexone is being trialed. With psilocybin, perhaps the most promising of these, people who have taken it for their grief, myself included, have reported major epiphanies and perspective changes about their loss. These are all promising in their own way, but we must be careful in how we use them for grief, as that will only become more important as their potential progresses. And finally, it's time to expand what we mean by grief. There are implicit grief hierarchies under which we operate, where we think of deceased children, spouses, and parents as meriting the most attention. But there are all kinds of grief, including those in breakups and divorces, climate change, and the experience of racism. Grief can be challenging to define sometimes, as with ambiguous loss, a concept coined by Pauline Boss, a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota, where there's a lack of facts surrounding a loss. This could be a psychologically absent father or a soldier whose body never made it home. There's nothing tangible to grieve, yet there has undeniably been some kind of loss. With these additional forms of grief, a different framework of thinking is required. Instead of striving for an endgame with grief, a cure, we must find a way to legitimize more kinds of grief, bringing them further into the public conversation, holding grief in one hand and a functional future in the other.
Thank you, Cody. That was Cody Delestrati with five big ideas from The Grief Cure, Looking for the End of Loss. You might also enjoy our book bite for This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder by Alan Townsend. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.